Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Hello, it's Healthy Gut Girl, Kitty Martone, and this is Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. And I'm coming to you live from deep inside your gallbladder. What? Yes, it's true. If you have a gallbladder, which our guest today does not. And that's what he's here to talk to us all about. I'm going to make this intro short because the episode is quite long and it's really good. And I know from my history, my family, my mother, so many women that I know without gallbladders or with gallbladder issues or with fatty liver issues or with cholesterol issues, I know how important this topic is, and his information is going to blow your mind. And what's so special about Nurse Mike Fave is his name. He is a nurse and a researcher, and he, like so many practitioners in this field that we're in, right? Not just the health field or the medicine field, the medical field, but this field, that where people are either taking responsibility for their own health and their, or they're teaching people what they've learned and then using that in their practice. So he has an incredible story to tell. And I think the perfect kind of teacher. He's my kind of teacher because he explains things very, very well. So, take notes again. Trust me, this is one of those ones you're going to want to listen to a few times because it's important to you. Trust me, to you and your gallbladder and your liver. All right. So catch you on the backside.
I'm super excited to have you on, genuinely, because I run the Estrogen Dominance Support Group on Facebook and we have like 22, 23,000 members now. And that's not a huge amount, but they're largely active. Our analytics say it's like 80% active. And that's cool. So these women are hanging on to what these guests I'm having on are saying. And I've never had anyone on to talk at length about liver gallbladder health. And I'd love for you to start this off by telling us how come you don't have a gallbladder.
Okay. Sounds good. Well, I appreciate the invitation, of course. So I actually don't have a gallbladder. I'm in my 20s and I'm also male. So I'm not the typical demographic group that you would assume wouldn't have a gallbladder. And essentially, my kind of health journey personally started with pretty significant digestive issues, going to doctors, gastros, specialists, surgeons, etc. And no one could really figure out what was going on. I got the Pepcid. You have gastric reflux, take your Pepcid or your Protonics. The specialist, I think the gastro, got tired of me and he was like, okay, go to the surgeon and see what the surgeon has to say. And I guess to a hammer, everything's a nail. So the surgeon was kind of like, it's your gallbladder. We're going to take it out. And what I was told during the process was the gallbladder is unnecessary. And the second thing I was told was that perhaps a pouch will form in the biliary system to deal with the bile, which I don't think actually happens. So
I've never heard that one.
At that point, I was like 17, 18 years old. Mm. 16, 17. So I was involved in nutrition and diet stuff at that point as well. I started with bodybuilding, diets, and getting into that, but I didn't have the same level of knowledge or understanding of things. And I was kind of trying to figure it out by myself because my parents aren't medical professionals. And the doctors I was going to weren't really helping. There wasn't really any solutions. And I was very sure I didn't have gastroesophageal reflux disease or anything like that. Mm-hmm. So I didn't really want to get the surgery. I wasn't a fan of the surgery, but at that point I couldn't eat essentially. So I was doing these fasting. So I'd go to school. I would basically fast all day long because I would have extreme pain after eating. And by the time I got to the evening, I would have a singular meal because I knew I was going to have this gallbladder attack for like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours. So if I had my meal at like 7, maybe like 5, 6, 7, I would have it for a while and then I could still go to sleep and go to school. Wow. So I wound up losing ridiculous amounts of weight. So currently I'm 6'2". At that point, I was like 6 foot, 6'2", around the same height. Right now I sit around 205 pounds, but at that point I was like 150 pounds or so. So I was very, 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 very lean, very, very underweight, very skinny. Mm-hmm. I felt absolutely terrible. So basically it was like, you have to do this surgery because you're super underweight, et cetera. So I wound up going with it. Afterwards, I stopped having gallbladder attacks because I didn't have a gallbladder anymore, but my digestive system was tarnished. Like, I had problems pretty much ever since. And so that was an impetus for me to start to develop or understand or create solutions for digestive issues and trying to figure out what exactly is going on with digestive tract, what's going on with the liver, what's going on with the gallbladder, et cetera. That went through stints of paleo and plant-based and vegetarian and carnivore and intermittent fasting and biohacking. And then eventually I fell into the bioenergetic space. Jay is another individual I run my, run our podcast together. Yeah. I'm sure he was on with you. Yeah. So, yes. Jay and I fell into the bioenergetic stuff together, and we went through the initial milk and orange juice situation. And then over time, that's also had its own progression. And, now here I am at this point, my digestive issues are largely solved to a large extent. And I still don't have a gallbladder.
It didn't grow back, huh?
Yeah, it definitely didn't grow back.
Magic pouch didn't come.
I wish. It's definitely, there's definitely been some negative effects in my life from not having a gallbladder that has required me to maintain a relatively strict dietary regimen on a regular basis, because, and we can get into some of this and unpack some of this if you're interested, some of the like benefits and functions of the gallbladder, and then what are the problems that you can have if you don't have a gallbladder. And I guess we can also, if you want to talk about some of the pathology that can lead to the gallstone formation and issues with the gallbladder.
Absolutely. Let's just start there. Yeah.
In my personal situation, when I was dealing with the gallbladder problem, I was trying a raw-ish plant-based diet, because it was kind of the, I had done the bodybuilding stuff, and I had gotten in my mind this idea that if you want to perform well, like if you want to perform like a race car, you need to have the right amount of fuel or the right type of fuel. So yeah. I was playing around with different diets, and the diet I had settled on at this point was a raw food diet, with plant-based diet with legumes and lots of green vegetables and salads. And then like the protein sources that I was sticking to at this point were mostly lean protein sources like chicken or fish. And then eggs, because I just come from the bodybuilding background, which is of the idea that saturated fats and things along those lines lead to heart disease or are not ideal for performance. So I was involved in different levels of dietary understanding and ideologies and dogma throughout the whole process. So during this phase, that was my current one. And what I had started to have happen was, after I'd eat, I'd get these like really terrible abdominal pains, and it would start under the right side and kind of the center and then move to my back. That's like a very traditional gallbladder symptom profile. Mm-hmm. Usually that there's referred pain to the back. Now, what does this diet have to do with my gallbladder specifically? Why am I bringing that up? So the gallbladder is affected by quite a few things. And I guess before we get into what it's affected by, what does it actually do? So the gallbladder is a space in your body. It's like a little sack, for lack of a better term, that concentrates bile. And what bile does is it's released with a meal by the gallbladder. The gallbladder contracts, kind of squirts out the bile. It moves through the cystic duct, which is the duct from the gallbladder, and then it moves into the common duct, which goes into the small intestine. And it releases these bile acids. The bile acids help to emulsify fats, so kind of mix them up and break them down a bit so that our intestine can absorb them. Now, even if you don't have a gallbladder or adequate bile acid from like a lack of a gallbladder, you can still digest fats, but there is some impairment that's going on. So
the gallbladder doesn't make the bile. It's the liver that makes it. It just houses it. It holds it.
And like it concentrates it. So in the gallbladder, the bile becomes more concentrated, but it is the composition of the actual bile and the bile itself is created by the liver and determined by the liver. So if you have anything affecting the liver in a negative type of way, or different hormonal processes, that can directly alter bile acid composition. And we'll talk specifically about estrogen dominance and its effect on bile acid composition, and then the subsequent formation of gallstones. But the any problems with the liver can impair the or affect the bile acid, and then that can lead to gallbladder issues, because the composition of the bile acid, if it's changing inside the gallbladder, it can precipitate or lead towards stone formation, things along those lines. Also, different hormones can affect the contractility of the gallbladder. So one of the, like estrogen as an example, can affect contractility. And then things like hypothyroidism can directly affect contractility of the gallbladder, composition of the bile acid, and liver function as well. So if you're dealing with any of those hormonal symptoms, you may have that effect. Now, with the diet that I was on, it was a lot of raw greens. So while I was running this diet, my resting heart rate was in the 40s. Mm-hmm. I was freezing cold. I didn't check pulse and temp at this point. I wasn't, you know, into the repeat stuff. And I felt absolutely terrible. I was cold, low energy, extremely low heart rate, typical hypothyroid symptoms. At this point, I wasn't aware of what could have been causing that or what the problem was. Also, the doctors I'd went to weren't aware either. I'd went to a cardiologist for chest pain. They didn't say anything about the low heart rate. I'd seen alternative doctors. They didn't really put two and two together. But essentially, looking back, the raw kale, the raw broccoli, I was doing some juices sometimes, a lot of the raw greens. I was definitely suppressing my thyroid at that point, which could have directly led to issues with the liver and the gallbladder, which is why you would have seen issues with that at somebody at my age. You know, you don't usually see 18-year-olds, 17-year-olds losing their gallbladder, particularly mm-hmm. men, because it's more of the demographic is usually more in women. The second thing is large amounts of legumes in the diet. There's, depending on the type of legume, they have certain components in them that can alter bile acid composition and predispose towards increased cholesterol secretion to the bile acid. And then also that can lead to the formation of gallstones over time. Now, legumes also, and again, it depends on the legume, because not every type of legume has these different components, but the legumes can also bind bile acids. So there isn't some element where they can be helpful depending on the type. So you have mm-hmm. multiple factors going on there. The last factor that I'll say is I was eating a relatively low fat diet, so I wasn't inducing contraction of the gallbladder. And so what you can see in the research is if you have people on these really low fat weight loss diets and they start to lose a lot of weight, you can see this increased formation of gallstone or increased risk of gallstones because they're not allowing their gallbladder to contract. So as the bile acid sits in the gallbladder, it gets very concentrated. The stones can sort of precipitate and then you can form gallstones. So in my particular circumstance, and I'm using this kind of as an example, the hypothyroid state plus the lower fat diet, plus the heavy consumption of legumes, I think predisposed me towards forming these gallstones, or at least inflaming my gallbladder. I didn't actually have stones at this point. Uh-huh. When they took it out, they didn't find any stones. The gallbladder was just very inflamed. Yeah, it's kind of frustrating. Yeah. So, but I think the what was happening was the whatever the bile acid composition that was coming out was irritating or causing an inflammatory response inside the gallbladder. And then the other dietary components may have been also inflaming that area as well.
Okay.
So
now I know a lot of youngsters that are on vegan diets these days, and a lot of them, and vegetarian and vegan. So would you say that you had an existing, like some existing gut dysbiosis prior to all of that? Or do you, like, you know, a lot of kids do, but some don't, because they do okay as youngsters, right? Because when you're young, your body can rob Peter to pay Paul all day long and all year until it can't anymore. And that's when you're usually in your 30s. So what happened with you? Would you think you had some gut dysbiosis prior, or did, like, maybe some ongoing stress, some high cortisol, stuff like that?
So for me, I think that it maybe not gut dysbiosis per se, but I definitely was sensitive to a lot of different foods that I didn't pick up on it till later. And in hindsight, it was kind of 2020. So as an example, like, I have never personally done well with dairy, However, like during the different bodybuilding phases and stuff I was doing, I was trying to gain weight. So I was drinking milk, and then I would get these symptoms or gut issues or like bloating or gas or things like that. And I don't think it was like a dysbiosis. I think it was more of me not tolerating those things. So at this point, I wasn't aware enough to really put two and two together and realize, okay, hey, some of these foods I'm eating are causing an issue. But I was aware enough to start to realize that things were problematic. And that's why I started to adjust my diet and try all these different things. The problem, and I think that this is what happens to quite a bit of people, is you kind of find, you stumble upon these different gurus or approaches or ideologies, and they're touted as like these cure-all things, right? So either, and even that, I don't want to like put it in a bad light, but even for some of the bioenergetic stuff, it's like fix your metabolism and all problems are solved, or right, paleo is like eat like a caveman and all problems are solved, and then vegan is remove all animal foods and you won't get heart disease and cancer. So you kind of, if you don't have a lot of background knowledge or reference experience inside these different dietary paradigms, it's easy to get pulled into one because like, oh, maybe there's something there, like I don't know. So for me, I went through that process because I started to realize I was having problems with different foods, and I was trying to optimize my function to work. Like I was playing basketball, I wanted to go to college for basketball, I wanted to look a certain way. So I was like, early on, I think it started when I was like 12, my dad and I went to the gym, and it was just, if you do these certain things, you can have these certain outcomes. So I hooked on to that, and I started to realize that different things impacted me different ways. So I started to get sucked down these different dietary pathways and whatnot, or ideologies, however you want to label them. And then that's what led to these different circumstances. So I wouldn't say that I had a dysbiosis. I would say that I was probably sensitive to things, wasn't aware of it, started to try to adjust as I became aware. And then I created a dysbiosis for myself through some of these extreme diets that I was running. So I think a lot of my stuff initially was self-induced. And then something I do want to touch on a slightly tangentially is, you said that a lot of people are like robbing Peter to pay Paul, and they're finding that they're having these negative effects when they're 30. In my experience, I'm starting to see like people in my generation and in the younger generation starting to find their effects like as soon as they're 20, as soon as they finish growing, as soon as like puberty stops, they have these severe issues, or even a lot of people are finding issues even within puberty. So I think that it's like,
I agree with that.
It's getting progressively worse. Yeah.
I've been in this, you know, space for 17 years now. And I can say that, you know, especially with the estrogen dominance group for almost 8 years now, where the women joining were almost all perimenopausal in their late 30s, 40s, 50s. Now it's easily early 20s. In fact, a lot of mothers are in their 40s joining and asking questions about their children, their daughters who are, you know, 16, 17. It's definitely changing. Yeah. Anyway, carry on.
I've seen it's interesting too, and this, I guess, a slightly tangential for your audience, but working in the hospital, I get to see like different generations, right? So I have patients who will be 92 years old in the ICU, or I have patients who will be 40 years old. And it, perhaps this isn't so scientific, more like anecdotal, but I've seen some older groups actually fare better in some of these processes than some of these younger groups. So I've seen like a 100-year-old lady recover from a stroke, whereas a 40-year-old lady completely paralyzed on the entire one side and not making progress from recovery. So I don't know if there's not like, I don't think as much studies as much as some of the epidemiologic data talking about rises in disease in younger populations, but I think there's like some degree of increased resistance to disease, or I have ladies in their 40s and 50s who have responded better to coming off carnivore, et cetera, and making dietary adjustments and improving their digestive health, et cetera, decreasing some of their symptoms of diabetes, lowering A1Cs, things like that. Whereas I have some young women that I'm working with in their 20s who are just struggling with trying to eat these various foods off after coming off of the vegan diets. So it's definitely a interesting thing to see, because it's not what I would have normally expected. I would have expected to have a more difficult time or a slower approach with people who are older, just because of the age factor, not even because of anything else.
You know, I had Georgi Dinkov on this morning, and he said actually had a statistic. He actually said that the statistics for elderly people with non-communicable diseases is actually going down, and that that younger people showing up with non-communicable diseases is on a crazy rise. So just confirming what you just said. So yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah, you're seeing, I've seen some of those studies, and I see some of the ones that Georgie's posted, and just like the rises in cancer and mental disorders and like major depression, things like that are kind of skyrocketing. And I am seeing that in the different populations that I'm working with, and kind of seeing that breakdown with what's going on with different people. It's just hard to, you know, it's hard to come up with like a research data point just based off my N equals one experience as a practitioner.
Right.
So. Yeah.
Well, it's important. That was an important tangent. I think people, you know, people are seeing it in their own lives. And whether it's in a group, Facebook group, or, you know, working for you with patients, it's like we're seeing it. We know it's happening. So, well, I think it's important on my little tangent is to say that, you know, people like yourself and me and Jay and all these people who actually and Georgie who have these experiences are bringing you to the forefront of being able to treat them and know what you're doing, right? Or me just sharing the knowledge and like with having people like you on, because I think it's so important. It's going to actually shape how we're able to care for people as it continues to get worse, because you know it is, unfortunately.
Yeah, I think it's really important to start to bring some of these different ideas and philosophies about health to light, because we can see what the outcome is with the current philosophical system as far as like traditional Western medicine. Now, I work in both sides, right? So I'm have one foot heavily entrenched in like the bioenergetic perspective, and I've spent over like close to a decade like really spending time with Ray's work and the research. And then I also have about almost 6 years working in the hospital as a nurse. So I get to see kind of both outcomes. Now, I don't want to entirely trash Western medicine, because there's definitely like some of the lab testing, not entirely, but there's definitely some elements of it that are extremely helpful. And some of the research and like medical research and stuff, there's a ton of benefit there. But I think a lot, like the general philosophy underpinning how people are treated and like the perspective of disease processes, is not conducive for health. It's essentially with the way I see things in the hospital, unless you're bleeding out and dying, or you're having like a severe diagnosable situation. I mean,
sometimes you're a nail and you need a hammer.
Yeah. Essentially that's really what it comes down to. So this other sphere of people trying to actually take responsibility for their health and make differences in their own health and figure out ways to improve their lives and have a healthy lifestyle and think outside of like their traditional 12 servings of whole grains and yada yada, and realizing, oh, this is not working for me. I think that is like, that's a great thing. And something you mentioned is having these reference experiences. So I think a lot of people are having building reference experiences and running through these different diets and kind of coming through and saying, okay, I did plant-based, I had problems, and then I went to paleo and keto and carnivore, and it solved some of those problems, but I had other problems. And then they kind of, there's like this kind of end spot, which is the bioenergetic perspective.
Yeah.
And so then it's like working through that. But in working with people, I think it's really important to build up those reference experiences and have people be aware of their own experiences, so that they can say, when I did X, Y, and Z with this diet, I had this outcome. And then ask the question. So when I was eating large volumes of legumes or greens on this vegan diet, I had XYZ outcome, impaired thyroid function, or cold hands, cold feet, symptoms that look like thyroid function, or impaired liver function, symptoms that looked like that, digestive issues, et cetera. And then be able to turn around and say, okay, so when I start this new dietary paradigm or these new experiments, how can I take this information that I've previously learned and then incorporate that and move forward and continue to build this base of knowledge in terms of figuring out what's working for them. And I think that's a very important element, is trying to figure out what's working for the individual, what's moving that needle for them, and not getting stuck in some of these individual ideologies, and maybe taking the things that work, the principles that work, and then applying them to what's working for them and then testing out other principles as they go. So it's, you don't get stuck in one camp. You kind of start to develop your own perspective. And for me, that's essentially what I've done for myself,
right,
or what I do for clients, or what Jay and I did together as we went through the process together. So,
Danny Roddy said that, he said, you know, if you are hanging on to every word of a guru, even if it's Ray Pete, you're going to find yourself in trouble at some point, because you really need to, like you said earlier, you couldn't digest dairy. And if you were hanging on to every word that Ray Pete said, you would keep eating dairy, or you keep trying every possible way to eat dairy. And so in my group, that's always what we're saying. We're like, listen, we'll post a study or we'll post something. And then we'll say, look, this isn't everyone. This may not be you, you know, don't, and also don't take offense to the fact that we're like, dairy is one of the best superfoods you can possibly consume. And they're like, well, then they get mad, because they're like, I can't consume that. And I can show you research that says it's not good for you. And now you've taken it personally. And now it's made, it's turned into something it shouldn't be. Like, we should be, it's almost like your very own Rubik's Cube. Like, you need to be doing that for your individual self, because, you know, like you said, it's just very individual journey that you have to understand from your point of reference and not from anyone else's, really.
Yeah, you have to test things out, because even with certain compounds, so say as an example,
progesterone.
What was that?
I said progesterone.
Yeah, so that's what I was going to say. Something really? That I think would be relevant to this particular group is the use of progesterone. So in my experience, a lot of women I work with love progesterone, but it doesn't always start out that way. So I've had multiple women who have initially started with progesterone have quite not so great experiences. Maybe they see like a lot of water retention. Maybe they can see changes in mood. Maybe they feel like very sluggish. Maybe they get a little more irritable. And so these are all possible outcomes or possible side effects of using progesterone that you can experience. And it's, you can't predict perfectly how some compound is going to interact with somebody's individual physiology. Mm-hmm. So in studies, you can see like this general outcome of what's happening. But again, there's this a whole bunch of factors moving in different people. So testing is important and context is important. So as I mentioned, initially, quite a few women I've worked with don't find that progesterone is ideal for them at first. However, as you make some adjustments, you adjust diet, you adjust other supplementary things, you adjust different lifestyle factors, and then you bring progesterone on and you play with dosage and timing and things like that, you start to realize, oh, in this context, progesterone actually feels great. Like, it's working very well for me. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I think is really important, is the individual testing and then understanding your context and then taking your experiences into consideration and placing value on those and trying to make sense of those. That's, that's, I think, how people will eventually be able to step out of whatever they're dealing with and find solutions to it, is really investing themselves in the process. And something that the modern medical community doesn't do is there's not a sense of taking responsibility. If you go to your doctor and you're like, I read this study on PubMed, I would bet the vast majority of doctors would be like, well, I have a medical degree. So I don't care about your singular study. So that's like, it's completely discounted. It's kind of like you rely on an authority and you outsource your health. Whereas I think if you really want to make progress in your health, you can have guides or you can have information sources, and then you can use those to like take your self responsibility and determine what's working for you and go from there. That I think is the best way to go. And for me, that's what essentially allowed me to deal with my own personal issues, gallbladder and whatnot, et cetera.
Right. That was well said. So I don't know if I can take that progesterone and steer it back onto the gallbladder thing about, some women take progesterone and actually have gallbladder pain. So I'm curious as to the role of estrogen and the gallbladder.
Okay. So estrogen has a couple really interesting effects, particularly on the liver and in cholesterol regulation. I actually just posted a study recently on my Instagram talking about this little snippet, but estrogen can lower serum cholesterol directly by increasing the LDL receptor on the liver. So it basically increases the influx of cholesterol into the liver. And then the next thing that estrogen can do is estrogen can increase the efflux or the removal of cholesterol from the liver and push into the bile acids. So it can start to increase the saturation of cholesterol in the bile acids. Now, this is important because one of the main stones that are formed inside the gallbladder are cholesterol-based stones. So you get these cholesterol crystals, they kind of clump together as the bile acid becomes very saturated, kind of like if you have try to put too much sugar in water, the sugar won't fully dissolve, it'll stay as crystals. If you try to put too much cholesterol in bile, it won't fully dissolve and you can kind of get these gallstones. So the estrogen, and if you have an excess of estrogen, you have this high amount of estrogen. And again, it's not just like estrogen by itself, because again, there's progesterone to estrogen ratio and things along those lines. But in general, an excessive amount of estrogen can lead to the formation of gallstones through this pathway and also lower serum cholesterol, which may or may not be ideal depending upon what you have going on and what your outcomes are. So that's one of the main pathways. There's other more like in-depth cellular pathways with the different estrogen, the estrogen receptor 1 versus estrogen receptor 2, but the general idea is this: taking cholesterol out of circulation and putting it into the bile acids. And then estrogen can also in some studies increase the formation or production of cholesterol by the liver, but it's just not allowing it to fully circulate.
Now, why would estrogen do that? Would you say that it has something to do with the lack of progesterone? And so it, because we know that when that ratio of E to P is off, that estrogen starts doing naughty things. But I mean, Morley Robbins would say the estrogen is doing that for a reason, like there's something happening. And my guess would be like a B6 deficiency or something having to do with a deficiency of some vitamin or something. Is that a good guess?
I don't think it's like a function of like a vitamin deficiency. So, I think that's a good guess, but the different hormones have like a overall different contextual function, right? So like they are doing things for a reason. You have this signaling for a reason. As an example, you have like estrogen and cyclically is increased to increase the proliferation or ready the proliferation of the uterus so that you can prepare to have a baby, whereas the progesterone is signaling for the differentiation of the egg once it's in fertilized and implanted, etc. So there's general functions of these different hormones over a broad context. Mm-hmm. Now, it's hard for me to kind of place what the actual direct context of estrogen is by itself in terms of trying to increase bile or the efflux of cholesterol or the formation of cholesterol into the bile acids. But I think there's broad ranging effects of these hormones across different parts of the body. And they're signaling different things. Like estrogen can also be related to stress. Mm. And it can also be, I think Dr. Pete's term for this was like the hormone of new beginnings. So it's like it has like a growth and development or growth and division.
Oh, of course. Right. Like mitogenic, yeah. Like it divides and grows like a baby or like a fetus or like a tumor, right? It
exactly.
Causes cells to divide and grow. Got it. Okay.
Yeah. So I would think of the hormones like more broadly across their like general overall effects, but sometimes it's kind of hard to place the specific effect, at least currently, the specific effect in that overall context. So like it's easy to contextualize estrogen and the cycle and then also what's going on with a baby and why it's elevated during pregnancy. And it's also easy to contextualize progesterone there. But then the broad ranging other effects throughout the body can be sometimes hard to contextualize with all of those larger pictures in mind. So that's something for me that I continue to work on with that. But as like a general pathway, you can see like this movement of estrogen dominance towards leading to the saturation of bile and cholesterol and bile. The other thing that you can see with estrogen dominance is estrogen dominance has a negative impact on thyroid function. Mm. So it can decrease thyroid hormone production at the gland itself and increase serum TSH and then lower T3 and T4 to some extent. Now, this doesn't mean that just like estrogen by itself is bad and that it's just like always going to cause these problems. Again, it's like, how much estrogen do you have? What's the ratio with some of the other hormones? What's your general body state? Like those things, it's always important to take those things into context, because I just something to mention in the sphere or the bioenergetic sphere is there's this idea that estrogen is just always bad and that you want to like kind of lower it as much as possible. But what I found is people, it will tend to have problems. I think a lot of young guys will try to completely crush their estrogen,
right,
and will tend to have problems and symptoms from that. So again, it's important to keep in mind that like there is a function for estrogen in the body. It does mm-hmm. have a purpose, and it's the context of what it's being used for is important. So like some degree of estrogen is necessary, but like a massive amount of estrogen, like amounts promoted by the Western medicine in terms of hormone replacement therapy, it's not ideal overall. And then it also needs to be balanced by progesterone, etc.
Right. There's the magic word, right? Balance.
Yeah, exactly.
Can you speak on the birth control pill? Because I know one of the reasons that women are at, what, 65% more women, maybe, I don't know if that stat has changed, get their gallbladder removed more than men. And that a lot of theories are that, or one specific theory is that the birth control pill.
First off, the synthetic estrogens and progestins and progestogens that are in birth control is not a great thing to use. And I have to be careful because as far as being a nurse, whatnot, doctor prescribes, that's what you use. But the studies using synthetic hormones are largely negative. And there's tons of problems with those on the breast, on the uterus, on different organs, et cetera. So I would be highly cautious about using those. The other thing is, just as a preface here, a lot of women are pushed by the doctor to say, hey, you have acne, you have PMS, you have this, you have that. Okay, go on birth control, instead of trying to figure out what the underlying situation is. So that's, I think there's a huge problem with that. Now, in specifically to the gallbladder situation or the gallstone situation, a lot, the general, and perhaps it's not so flattering, but in medicine, there's this idea around who generally gets gallbladder issues, and it's called the four Fs. And I don't want to offend anybody, but this is like what they teach us in school, and it's female, fair, fat, and 40. And the reason they have that is like, that's the population that you generally see gallbladder issues with.
Fair, now, really? As in like fair. Caucasian women.
Yep.
Wow.
Now that may be adjusting over time, but that was like the traditionally understood demographic. So like in nursing school, we literally get the mnemonic, the four Fs for gallbladder disease. Exactly. So
that's going to have to change soon with this cancel culture. Let me tell you right now. I'm just kidding.
Oh, I'm sure it's already changed.
Probably,
I'm sure,
right?
They're already changing that right now. Yeah. You probably can't say things like that in like a nursing school anymore.
But you know, these are just facts. I mean, let's just be honest. Like this is, we can't ignore that data, and that helps people remember it. And so, you know, there it is.
Well, it kind of speaks to what's going on in these situations, right? So women generally have a higher estrogen burden than men, at least during the first portions of their life. Older men, obviously, that can adjust. The other thing is, as far as fair, I don't know the specifics there. Perhaps that was just a statistic. Mm-hmm. 40 years old is generally around times where women start to move towards menopause and whatnot. So you have a shift in the progesterone and estrogen ratio, and then you have adjustments in ovarian function. And then usually if a woman is overweight, then you can assume that there's some hormonal components going on there. Specifically, fat tissue does have a large amount of aromatase, which can increase estrogen as well. And then also, if an individual is overweight, the question is what could be leading to, depending on how overweight, but usually in the hospital, it'll usually be women who are obese that you tend to see the gallbladder issues with. Mm-hmm. And in those situations, you have an actual metabolic dysfunction going on, and there's other hormones and things at play there, whether that's mitochondrial dysfunction or low-grade endotoxemia or elevated glucocorticoids and other stress hormones moving through those pathways as well. And all of those will have a direct effect on the liver function as well. As an example, endotoxin can directly increase cholesterol production by the liver, through some of the inflammatory cytokines like tumor necrosis factor alpha and interleukin 6. So
wow, say that again. Because I think that's really important.
So endotoxin directly increases the production of cholesterol by the liver through there are cytokines, they're cell signaling molecules of inflammation. One is called tumor necrosis factor alpha, and the other one is called interleukin 6. So when you're in this, I know you wanted to mention like liver health and endotoxin and alcohol to some extent. And these are like some of the pathways that these common things can work through, but it's also relevant to gallbladder issues and whatnot as well. A lot of people tend to find, and well, another, I guess, interesting tidbit here, and I guess we didn't get to cover it because we've kind of been moving in different directions,
sorry.
But no, it's okay. Of course, the bile acids are, besides emulsifying fat, are antibacterial, and they can degrade endotoxin. And so if you don't have adequate bile flow, you don't have adequate bile acids, you can predispose yourself to the formation of small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. Mm. The other thing is bile acids are directly involved in signaling in the small intestine that upregulates intestinal defense. So there's very important functions with bile acids there. And the other thing, bile acids in circulation have a direct relationship with thyroid hormone functioning. So this is why it's like, it's hard. There's a lot of different pathways and you start seeing like how all these things interact, but it's always hard to contextualize like, why are bile acids involved in thyroid hormone signaling? It's like, it's such a, like, I've asked myself this question many times and I still like going through the research, like I know the pathway, but I still like trying to contextualize, like, what's the greater meaning of it over the system. And just as a side note, Dr. Pete was somebody who is brilliant in like contextualizing all these things and creating the picture. So that's a,
amen to that, because absolutely. Hey everyone, thanks for listening to this episode of Stuff Your Doctor Should Know. I wanted to briefly interrupt and remind you about Just Thrive spore-based probiotics, and I wanted you to listen to a quick clip of Kiran Krishnan, the celebrity microbiologist, talking about how important a diverse microbiome is and spore-based probiotics.
And the biggest issue with the allergies and all the crazy sensitivities, when you look at the prevalence rate of peanut allergies and environmental allergens, and the fact that asthma is now among kids is a pandemic, you know, all of these things are because of the loss of oral tolerance. The loss of oral tolerance means that what we used to be able to do is take in huge amounts of different, you know, proteins and antigens and things that people would now be allergic to. The immune system would be able to sample it. The bacteria within your gut would be there to help the immune system figure out, this is something you need to attack and this is something you need to leave alone. That's the process of immune tutoring. And that is lost when we lose the diversity in our microbiome.
Thanks for listening to Kiran Krishnan. If you want to use your coupon code HGG20 to get 20% off, just go to justthrivehealth.com and check out all the great things they have. And now back to the show. You know, just as a side note and tangent for me for a second, you know, Facebook and social media is such a sewer sometimes. And, you know, when we post a lot of repeat stuff, and this is quite recent, like within the last year that we've really been posting a lot of repeat stuff, and that I've been having all of these guests like yourself on, and people that don't know and they Google repeat, they right away, they just get this garbage, you know, and then they say, like, if he says something like, you know, estrogen actually can raise in age, it can raise in menopause, it just retreats into the tissues because progesterone goes down, you should see the backlash. And just today, before I had you on, there was some drama about something that one of my admins posted about, had taken a screenshot of a repeat quote. And people are just like, it's unbelievable. And I feel, because these are people in the hormone space that are helping other women. And mm-hmm. I just feel heartbroken because I just don't think that they know the gravity of what it is that Dr. Pete committed his entire life to. They don't understand what they're talking about in that regard. And it's just, you know, you don't have to hang on every word, but you do have to take it into consideration and hear it and look at it and examine it if you're going to be trying to helping people with their hormones. That's my tangent.
Yeah. And so a lot of first of all, the hormonal information that's taught inside, I know it. So right now I'm in school to become a nurse practitioner. So I know what the schooling process is, at least for that. And nurse practitioners in the United States, for anyone who lives out of country, have prescriber status. So a nurse practitioner can prescribe lab tests, can prescribe drugs. Now, regulation varies by state. So some nurse practitioners in some states are able to completely practice without having a doctor with them. Others have a doctor overseeing their work. And mm-hmm. then as far as prescription status, in some states they can't prescribe certain compounds, but in other states they can. So like Schedule I drugs like opiates and stuff may not be able to be prescribed by certain nurse practitioners in certain states. But the education in these situations is not, there's not like a super in-depth understanding of some of these hormonal pathways. Mm-hmm. So as an example, like for progesterone and estrogen, the progesterone is talked about in the context as like a progestational hormone involved in ovarian function and childbearing and
pregnancy hormone, right?
Pregnancy, exactly. But as far as like the broad ranging effects, like on the brain and neurosteroids and things like that, or liver function, or in terms of metabolic function or interaction with thyroid, like that is not ever covered, at least in the nurse practitioner curriculum. And as mm-hmm. far as I can tell, it's not covered in the medical curriculum either. The general curriculum is revolves around kind of this non-contextualized understanding of disease process. So it's, what I mean by that is that you looking at disease process in these like individual pathways and chunks. So it's like, this is what happens in gallbladder disease, and this is the treatment pathways, and this is what you have to do. But like, there's not a broader overarching understanding of, is the person hypothyroid and that's leading to a gallbladder issue? Or is there something in their diet that's leading to that? What's going on with their hormones? And then what's going on with gallbladder function or liver function and things along those lines? It's very much like disease pathway, treatment pathway, kind of take the triangle block, put it in the hole, understand the mechanisms and things like that. But this larger picture of why different things are happening doesn't necessarily get fully covered there. So MDs have much better, and at least in my experience, so I'll speak for myself, but MDs tend to have much better education in terms of the depth of these things than mm-hmm. NPs and PAs. And so even then, I haven't seen that level of depth of understanding in at least working with some of the doctors in the hospital. And again, that's my personal interpretation. I don't want to make a broad statement for all things because I haven't gone through medical school in the US. So just nurse practitioner, nursing school, et cetera.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. Once again, it's compartmentalized, and that's just the way the system was set up from a long time ago. So where were we though, right before you had made the repeat statement? Because you said something really valuable right before that in regards to—
I was talking about endotoxin and cholesterol production. Yeah.
So the reason that I really wanted to dig into that was because, you know, I'm healthy gut girl, and I've been talking gut health for 17 years now and helping people in that way. But I really didn't start talking about endotoxin. I always tried to keep things sort of very much non-clinical and just like really just address things in layman's terms. But now endotoxin has made this incredible surge into the, you know, nutritional world. And I just want my listeners to understand, and this is news to me, what you just said about the cholesterol and the endotoxin. That is crazy. Because there's such a battle and I consider my group a little control group of women who are like dealing with this ongoing gut problem, whether it's SIBO or severe leaky gut. And again, with taking progesterone and those things getting worse instead of better. And it's just such a little rat's nest. And I want to be able to say, okay, endotoxin, not just carrot salad, but let's talk about gallbladder health. Even though carrot salad is huge and important, you know, what else can we do to support the reduction of endotoxin, and then throw in a little alcohol conversation there? Because so many of us, and I am guilty, mm-hmm. enjoy a frosty libation once in a while.
Okay, perfect. So let's kind of start with endotoxin. I'll bring the bile acids and gallbladder function and liver function in after that. And then we can touch on what goes on with alcohol and the endotoxin in the intestine. And there's some interesting studies we could talk about. I don't have quotes to pull for you like directly here, but we can talk about the general idea behind them. Okay. So first things first is, just in case anyone's unaware, endotoxin, another name for it is lipopolysaccharide, is a component of bacterial cell walls, particularly gram-negative bacteria. And it is a very potent inflammatory immune stimulant. So very small amounts of endotoxin, if you get into your bloodstream, can trigger like septic shock, which is essentially like complete circulatory failure. And then eventually like heart failure, you know, it's like a very, very dangerous toxin, and it creates a very profound and potent immune response. Now, this immune response works through certain receptors. One of the main ones is toll-like receptor 4. So this is expressed, or you see this on your immune cells, like white blood cells, like macrophages. And when they get a hold of this, they secrete these cytokines, like the ones I told you, these inflammatory mediators, interleukin-6, tumor necrosis factor alpha. And those mediators signal tons of processes all across the body. And so there's this whole field now, it's immune endocrinology. And so it's like the interaction of the immune system with the endocrine system. And the reason I'm bringing this up, I know, fancy names in the research, right?
Sounds like a fun field, something else to study.
There's some really interesting interactions where endotoxemia, or endotoxin and the cytokines it produces, can directly negatively impair your thyroid function, your liver function, and then also your hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis. So that whole reproductive function. So the low, like even a low grade endotoxemia, where you have a low amount of endotoxin leaking into the system on a regular basis, generally it's gut derived, so it's coming from the gut, can lead to these alterations in hormonal profile from thyroid to ovaries, to adrenals, et cetera, where you see this turning off of the thyroid, this turning off of ovarian function, and then this uptick in adrenal function. And you see this with the endotoxemia low grade with metabolic syndrome. You can see it with obesity. You can see it with heart disease. You can see it with cancer. There's literally autoimmunity. There's so many diseases that the endotoxin is directly involved in, and the signaling pathways, inflammatory pathways are directly involved in. So it's like one of the most ubiquitous toxins that we're exposed to on a regular basis because we have bacteria in our guts. So gut health is paramount and extremely important to almost every single disease process, largely through endotoxin. But something that's not discussed is endotoxin's like the main one everybody talks about now, but there's other toxins from different bacteria. One of them from gram-positive bacteria is lipotechoic acid. Then from colonic bacteria and protein fermentation, there's different compounds like hydrogen sulfide or p-cresol or ammonia or scatol or indol. So there's this whole litany of essentially gut toxins that can be created by the microbiome that move into circulation and can cause a whole host of metabolic diseases. And there's tons of studies in PubMed looking at like hydrogen sulfide or scatol or indol concentrations in dialysis patients, or the effects of hydrogen sulfide on atherosclerosis or endotoxin in atherosclerosis. So there's these gut toxins, and you don't have to know the individual ones. It's not like, you know, nobody has to like go in all the Wikipedia articles or the PubMed articles and like look at all these signaling pathways, but just knowing that these compounds that can be generated by the gut microbiota can be extremely inflammatory and cause a whole host of not only gut symptoms, but can cause a host of hormonal problems and other like chronic disease processes. So it's very important to maintain your gut and improve gut function on a regular basis. And I'll break here so you can go ahead. And
I feel the question.
But we could talk about how the gallbladder is important there as well.
Okay.
So go ahead.
It was just a silly question probably, but and a big one. Why do we make those? Why do we make that endotoxin? Why do those microbes make it?
Yeah. So there's a couple things. So the bacteria make it as part of a component of their cell wall. And the other toxins are created as part of their metabolic processes. So it's kind of like some of the bacteria. So like, as an example, hydrogen sulfide. Hydrogen sulfide is produced by bacteria that fix or use sulfur for their energy production. Some of those bacteria include Bilophilia wadsworthia or Disulfo vibrio piger. I know, funny names. You can see them. You can see them on a gut profile, and some of them actually show them now. Mm-hmm. But they basically use the sulfur for energy substrate for metabolic function. So they're not doing it to like poison you per se, but it's a process of their metabolic functions. Now they may produce some of those things to alter their niche in their, in the ecosystem in the gut, and impair other bacteria and allow for attachment to the intestine and things like that. But their overall, it's like, it's part of their general function. And then the endotoxin is part of like the structure of the bacteria. Now, why is it so inflammatory to humans? Well, our immune system has developed these defenses to say, hey, this protein, this isn't our protein. This is like an invasive protein. Mm. So the toll-like receptors are essentially receptors with the immune cells that say, hey, we have something here that's not supposed to be here. And so that's why the body is triggering this inflammatory response to say, hey, we need to clean this up, guys. Like, let's get together and let's fix this situation. We need to get these bacteria out of here. We need to get this endotoxin out of here. So there's coordinated responses to try to deal with that. The problem is in an acute situation, you get a skin infection, your immune system goes, clears it out. You have the cytokines, it changes all these processes to deal with that infection and then heal the tissue, eliminate the bacteria. That's good. But if you're chronically leaking endotoxin into your system on a low level all the time, and you're chronically stimulating these pathways, while they have a prioritization to deal with an initial problem, over the long term, you start to degrade other pathways because your body is prioritizing where to put energy and resources. And if you're dealing with an infection, your body's not like, oh, let's make a baby now too. It's kind of, let's deal with this infection. And then we can talk about making a baby after that. So it'll start to turn down these other processes to some extent. And that's where you kind of see, that's why you see these coordinated responses. I think that's the contextualization where you see these coordinated responses across multiple body systems and pathways with something like endotoxin and an immune response.
Okay. So is it like a byproduct? It's like a gaseous byproduct almost that like is meant to kind of happen to some degree, but then, like you said, a chronic, it's almost like the candida concept. It's like, you know, candida's native to our guts and we're meant to have it. It comes in to, you know, protect us, but then because we are eating a bad diet and we're stressed and we have all these other issues, the candida overgrows and mutates and becomes this like infection. And now you've got a real problem.
There's a couple things there. So first of all, there's multiple layers to it. So you have your body's defenses, and that's why it's so important to maintain general health. Because when health starts to fail, or you start to, you know, stress yourself out excessively by running 5Ks and cold thermogenesis and fasting and not eating any carbs and
CrossFit.
CrossFit and then trying to work 60 hours a week on top of that. And then like those types of things will decrease your body's ability to deal with these things, and you open yourself up. So the first step is, where's your general health? Usually people who have a general state of health, they usually don't have any problems with things like candida on a large scale. And even people who are compromised, you don't see them turn around and have like what I see in the hospital, like a fungal candidemia where the fungus is in the bloodstream. And then it's like, that's very dangerous. So most people's bodies are very resilient, and they may get like this low grade fungal infection in the gut or on the tongue or on their toenails or their feet or their groin or anything like that. It won't become systemic. But from the first place, the important point here is to avoid putting yourself in a situation where you're compromising your body's immune defenses, and then you open yourself up to these chronic latent infections. Now, the chronic latent infection is important because, again, if you have a candidal infection and you have this chronic low-grade immune response to the candida over time, another example is if you have infections in your teeth. There's strong associations with these types of infections. For example, like teeth, periodontal infections, low-grade chronic, with Alzheimer's disease and atherosclerosis, because you have this chronic inflammatory process. Mm. And so I'm actually going to, just as a side note for this, I'm making a video that discusses what happened, like what endotoxin does in terms of forming or creating or predisposing to atherosclerosis. Wow. And it's through these pathways. So like something I'm very interested currently. But these chronic infections can be a problem. So you don't want to open yourself up in the first place. Mm-hmm. The next piece with the gut is that the gut is an ecosystem. So you have all types of bacteria and microbes, fungus, archaea, all different types of things. It's not so simple as just like this thing is bad and that thing is good, because you have these different interactions with different bacteria. So some bacteria produce metabolic products that encourage the growth of other ones that may be beneficial. And so there's like very difficult, and this is what they're trying to do with the gut research now, is try to like narrow down what are the interactions and all these types of things. It's not like, and I think a lot of people experience this, you take your bifidobacteria, but it doesn't solve all your gut problems because you have an ecosystem situation going on. So a lot of the what becomes important with gut health is managing that ecosystem effectively. And what a lot of people find in the low-grade endotoxemia and heart disease and obesity and metabolic syndrome, et cetera, are associated strongly with the Western American diet and that low-grade endotoxemia, because the diet itself alters the ecosystem and then leads to these formation of these endotoxin-producing bacteria. So the goal is to shape your diet so that you are shaping the ecosystem in a beneficial way. And that's, for example, that's what I do with a lot of my clients, is adjusting diet and using different herbal compounds and whatnot over the long term and short term to shift what's going on in the gut while simultaneously shifting the body's resilience. So you have that as well.
Okay.
And then I guess the third piece, I feel a question coming, but the third piece is the, if you have some like strong infection in the gut, that can dysregulate a whole bunch of processes that can lead to like an alteration in the microbiota. So as an example, something that's relevant to a lot of people, viral infections like COVID-19 can induce dysbiosis in the intestine by creating an inflammatory profile through the interaction with like the angiotensin receptors and whatnot. And then that can lead to a dysbiosis, and people can have lingering gut symptoms following a viral infection. Even if it's not COVID, it could be the flu, it could be a cold. So those are like, if you haven't, say you have a chronic latent gut infection with Klebsiella pneumonia overgrowth, that can lead to dysbiotic situation and cause a whole host of problems as well. And then that bacteria is a gram-negative bacteria, you have this chronic leak of endotoxin. And then that's why you can see this gut derange the whole body systems going forward, from thyroid to ovarian function, et cetera.
I love that you said overgrowth, because it's so common, right, to see that people think, oh, they have H. pylori, how did I catch it? Right? Or the, you know, pneumonia, when actuality, you know, like you said, there's all these microbes that can be commensal, or they can be bad, they can be good. It just depends on what's going on in the gut. And they're constantly playing, like you said, like an ecosystem. And, you know, H. pylori is native to our lining of our stomach, right? And then it becomes an overgrowth, which then becomes an infection. And so I just love that you said that, because it gives people a perspective and gets us out of that headspace of we need to go in there and kill the bad guys, right? And that's really, I like that you said that. I didn't have a question. I was just getting a cramp in my foot, and I was like,
oh, no problem.
What's that about? Anyway, okay, this is great. All right, so we were going to bring it full circle to the gallbladder with the endotoxin, right?
Yep.
Okay.
So what I want to preface the gallbladder conversation with is, yeah, so there's a perception in the bioenergetic sphere that the gut should be like sterile or clean, completely clean. Now, it's kind of gets passed around, so it's like a cliche thing now in the sphere. A lot of people are saying that. There's like a whole time on the forum where people were like trying to run all these antibiotics to clean out their gut. Then the thing is that while the stomach and small intestine have a significantly decreased bacterial population, like that's known, it shouldn't have a lot of bacteria in those places, the colon will most likely never be sterile. Even if you continue to run antibiotics, because I see this in the hospital. So I have patients, we have them on like 3 or 4 different antibiotics because they have severe septic infections. We have to keep changing them because of sensitivity and things like that. Their guts become very clean, but then they get something called C. diff or Clostridium difficile, which is could be a life-threatening diarrheal infection. And it's a spore-forming bacteria. And it thrives when you destroy the ecosystem. You allow these pathogens to come in. So just a note there, having an ecosystem in the colon is important, and it helps to it helps you avoid having pathogenic microbes. So you're never going to have a sterile colon. You want the colonic ecosystem to be one that is commensal, one that is non-pathogenic. And that's, again, it's an ecosystem. It's not just like your colon should only be lactobacillus or bifido.
Right. It's like diverse, abundant. Yeah,
exactly. Okay. And the way you do that is largely through what you're eating on a regular basis. So just a note there. Now, as far as the stomach and the small intestine becoming staying relatively clean, they're not sterile. There's some bacteria, but compared to the amount of bacteria in the colon, it, you could almost say sterile because it's such a large difference in bacterial colonies. Mm. Now, the stomach is relatively clean because you have this hydrochloric acid and these proteolytic enzymes. Most bacteria are not, or microbes aren't going to solve those. And as a side note, having your metabolic function well and your thyroid function well is imperative for stomach acid production. So when you cause issues in that, from that perspective, and you decrease your stomach acid production, you can predispose yourself towards having bacteria and microbes take up residence in the small intestine. Now,
that's
the small
crazy.
Yeah. So that's another reason why you don't want to decrease your own like resiliency by doing these crazy biohacking things that are being promoted now. But the next thing is the small intestine also has its own processes for keeping bacteria at bay. And one of those is bile acids, as I kind of mentioned before. So the bile acids, they're bacteriostatic, bactericidal in some cases. They can actually break down endotoxin. There's also another enzyme called alkaline phosphatase that can actually degrade endotoxin as well. And they basically help to keep the digestive tract clear. So or the small intestine specifically. So what winds up happening is if you have adequate fat intake on a regular basis, and I think this is some of the benefits that people have with low carb, higher fat intakes, mm-hmm. they feel this gut improvement because they're triggering a lot of bile acid release on a regular basis. Mm-hmm. And it helps to clear that small intestine. And if they had any overgrowth or whatnot, it helps to, you're not having those FODMAP heavy foods anymore. So you don't have a lot of fermentation and bloating. So the combination of those, I think, are some of the main benefits for low carb and why people experience benefit. But the bile acids specifically are very helpful for clearing out the small intestine and keeping it clean. So you want to have that process going on. And then also, not only does the bile acids directly have that effect, but they do trigger defensive elements inside the small intestine that help to impair the adherence of bacteria to the lining and things like that. So bile acids are very important in digestive health from like that bacterial perspective overall.
Mm-hmm. And so what do you take? Because you don't have those bile acids.
I actually still, so if you don't have a gallbladder, you still produce bile acids. So I still produce bile acids. The problem is that you don't have a regulation anymore of bile acids, where when you eat fat, there's a hormone called cholecystokinin, and cholecystokinin says to the gallbladder, hey, there's fat here, contract, and it contracts and releases the bile acids. It also triggers digestive enzyme release as well. So having adequate fat in a meal can help to aid digestion. So I'm not low fat or anti-fat or anything like that. I think it's very helpful. Mm. But when you have the meal, you contract, you secrete the bile acids, and your intestine absorbs a lot of them. When you don't have a gallbladder, you're just constantly leaking bile acid into your intestine all the time. And so the problem is that you can start to develop bacteria that are able to metabolize those bile acids.
Oh no!
And then you can see things. That's where you start to see people have this overgrowth of things like Bilophilia wadsworthia and Disulfovibrio piger, because the bile acids contain amino acids that have sulfur in them. And so those bacteria are like, it's a party. We have all these sulfur containing amino acids, specifically taurine, which is one of the amino acids that gets conjugated to form a bile acid. Hmm. So that's one of the problems that I see with the bile acid stuff. The other thing is, some people, if they have the gallbladder situation, they get it removed, they won't produce enough bile acids. And then supplementing in that case can be helpful. You can use something like an ox bile, or you can use even something like TUDCA, which is a Urso deoxycholic acid. It's another type of bile acid. Those can be quite helpful. Mm-hmm. But the other problem is, if you don't have a gallbladder, you have a problem where you can over secrete bile acids. So in my situation, what I found is, if I eat past a certain amount of fat, I will dump bile acids. Now, bile acids in the small intestine are great, but bile acids in the colon are not great, because the bacteria get a hold of them. They convert them into something called secondary bile acids. and the secondary bile acids are extremely irritating to the colon and produce serotonin. Your colon will then produce serotonin in response.
And that is not good.
No, that's not good at all. They can also create like leakiness as well from like, because they have a detergent effect. So they can kind of like degrade those cells and irritate them a bit. So it's important if you don't have a gallbladder to regulate your fat intake. So there's no more like, you know, massive amounts of cheesecake or anything like that. For me, I've at least in my experience, I've had to keep my fat intake around 20 to 30 grams per meal. And then I won't have bile acid dumping. Now, something very important about bile acids is the fats that you eat in your diet change the type of bile acids that you produce. So more saturated fats, like what's a good one? Stearic acid or heavy amounts of palmitic acid. Those are types of saturated fat. They cause your bile acid composition to shift to be higher in taurine conjugated bile acids. The reason this occurs is because taurine conjugated bile acids are better at basically emulsifying or mixing up the saturated fats. So if you're having bile acid dumping and you're having a lot of bile acid production because you had your gallbladder removed, or you have gallstones and issues like that, it may be helpful to switch more towards a monounsaturated fat because it will alter the composition and the bile acid become a little less irritating. The other thing is if you have hydrogen sulfide overgrowth or bacteria of hydrogen sulfide or overgrowth of bacteria that are producing hydrogen sulfide, then you want to probably decrease your taurine conjugated bile acids for a period of time, and moving towards more monounsaturated fats can do that because it will decrease the amount of taurine conjugated bile acids. So that could be avocados, olive oil, beef, egg yolks, things along those lines.
Okay. Wow. I mean, that can get kind of complex because it depends on what you're feeling and what exactly you're experiencing when you go to the bathroom or what you feel like after you eat. So what about limonene? Do you ever use limonene or have you? Because that's something I used to work with Dr. Robert Marshall for many years. And he was like, look, if you don't have a gallbladder or you have gallstones or you have any kind of issues with seeing fat in your stool or he's like, you know, limonene is such a wonderful way. So you're not actually taking bile acids, because he would say, you don't know, that may not work for you. That may not. He never really expounded on why or why not. But he said limonene, anybody, everybody pretty much can take it. Can you speak on that?
So I haven't personally used limonene. For me, I think it can be helpful for sure. For me, and again, it depends on what's going on. If you don't have a gallbladder versus if you have a gallbladder and you have gallstones versus if you just are having like gallbladder pain, those are three different circumstances to consider. And the way I would handle each of those circumstances is somewhat different. Limonene, I think, is something that could be helpful. But what made a massive difference for me was adjusting the amount of fat I have in a meal, what types of fat that I'm eating. And then the other thing that is unfortunate for me is I'm a huge fan of glycine and taurine, but I can't supplement them because they drastically increase my bile acid output. Because those are the amino acids that are conjugated to form bile acids. So you need those amino acids to form bile acids. So as soon as I start taking larger doses of glycine and taurine, that's when I start to get like the bile dumping and irritation in my intestine. Okay. And again, making sure that your intestines aren't irritated chronically or leaky, and making sure that you're not drastically negatively impacting the microbiome is one of the most important steps, I think, personally, in improving energy metabolism because of how potent the gut toxins are, and then also irritation of the gut and serotonin production is in terms of negatively impacting hormones and metabolism.
Wow. Okay. And then I guess we can squeeze in some talk about the whole alcohol idea, unless you feel like, or tie those in together, and fatty liver, because
So alcohol is a very interesting one. I'm going to start off with an interesting study, or I guess a story about germ-free mice, and then we can talk about what this means. So there's some very interesting studies in mice that have no germs, no bacteria in their intestine, and it involves alcohol. So you can feed these mice alcohol.
They engineered them that way, right? They just aren't born that way.
They created them to be germ-free. It's not like they have to be in special environments so they don't pick up As soon as they come out of those environments, these sterile environments, like they will pick up the bacteria. And we're going to talk about this because this is something that they did in the study. So they have these germ-free mice. They feed them a bunch of alcohol. They get some liver dysfunction, but they don't progress to cirrhosis. And they don't get the severe negative effects that you see with alcohol in humans or mice that have bacteria in their intestine. So, or microbes in general. So what they did was they took the germ-free mice, give them much alcohol. They don't really get that much disease. Then they take these other mice, they give them alcohol, and their livers basically explode. That's really bad for their livers. Mm. Now, they take the bacteria out of the intestine of these mice that have like liver problems after drinking alcohol, and they put it in the mice that were germ-free. And what happens? Those mice develop this severe liver impairment. Like they get the cirrhosis and their livers then explode as well. Mm. So what's going on? So alcohol itself, it has some like metabolic toxicity because it gets converted to acetaldehyde and it's a little bit toxic. But the liver and the body, as long as you have good nutrition, is pretty good at handling that, pretty good at minimizing the effects of alcohol there. What the body has a really hard time with is alcohol opens up the gut barrier and causes endotoxin to leak into the portal supply. So that's the blood supply to the liver. Uh-huh. And then you're essentially just getting a nice hefty dose of endotoxin to the liver. And so the endotoxin that's generated during drinking alcohol, because the alcohol creates a dysbiosis in the intestine over the long term, as well as impairing intestinal barrier function. You basically, the liver just gets this constant dose of, as long, if you're continuously drinking, of endotoxin. Wow. And so that's what's really driving that cirrhosis process. Because endotoxin is extremely negative to the liver. It's like one of the most potent toxins that you can supply the liver with on a regular basis.
Wow, that's incredible. So endotoxin, I mean, there's a lot going on in this. This endotoxin's really bad for the liver. And then the alcohol on many levels seems to disrupt, our hormones. It seems to disrupt cognition. It disrupts. Yeah. So I thought you were going to give me a little bit of good news about alcohol. Like Georgie was like, you know, take a fair amount of thiamine. And I think it was thiamine, right? And, you know, it's going, I mean, he's not talking about someone who's ingesting alcohol all the time, but he's saying, you know, if you take thiamine, extra thiamine, it's going to help you with that. What do you think?
Yeah. So the B vitamins are very helpful, particularly thiamine, because they help with the processing of alcohol in terms of like its conversion to acetaldehyde and then the detoxification of this, of the alcohol. So it's important to have adequate B vitamins. Now, there are some studies that look at ways to protect yourself from alcohol. And so like while alcohol isn't really great overall, I think that you could probably still drink it in not large amounts and not necessarily like have really negative outcomes from it. Mm-hmm. If you already have gut issues or you already have significant hormonal problems, it's probably not ideal. Mm-hmm. Now, what I do want to talk about just tangentially before I continue on some of those things is there's a reason I think people drink alcohol, and I don't think it's just because in most circumstances, alcohol has a central nervous system depressing effect and a kind of an anti-stress effect for people because it works through the GABA pathways. So alcohol is it's a way people cope with stress, just like nicotine and cigarettes are. It's like when you're under stress, you smoke a cigarette. So when I work with clients, and I do have clients who drink, my first outcome is not to try to stop them from drinking. Because if they're under stress and they're dealing or smoking or whatever these different things are, my outcome is to try to minimize their stress so that they, and then replace the crutch or the substance that they're using, like alcohol, marijuana, cigarettes, with something that also helps them from a stress perspective. Also, you can modulate some of the addictive pathways with different supplements. That's a different story, but the goal is to replace the substance with something else. So it's like, if you're under stress, you don't go to alcohol, you go to maybe progesterone. That's like a random example. Mm-hmm. There's other substances as well. So that's important to contextualize that, because it's for a lot of people, you can't just stop, especially if that's been something you've been using to try to get you through difficult times. Mm-hmm. So it's important to put that into perspective. create an environment or a circumstance where you don't need to rely on that and that you have other options. And then I found it much easier for people to get off of these different habits once they're feeling better and they have other substances that they can use.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
I mean, that's incredibly, I think Kate Deering was the first one to kind of mention it to me about cortisol levels. And when people that tend to have, who are like worriers and tend to have high cortisol, that they kind of can fall back on that. They'll start to crave like should the carbohydrates, like simple carbohydrates, they'll start to crave alcohol and for the same similar reasons. My issue with it, and I'd be totally transparent and my listeners know, and they can, a lot of them relate, is that a lot of times it's not like stress as in like I had a stressful day. A lot of times it's like the inflammatory condition that, you know, a lot of us have been dealing with. A lot of women have EBV, they've got different types of herpes, they've got Lyme, and that stress, which is impactful in simple things like just getting through your day without like a head fog or without, and like, oh gosh, I could really use some wine right now. That's going to really help me decompress. And so, but it's such a sad, it's such a bad joke because it's, you know, also feeding the endotoxin, which is news to me. So that's, I mean, you said opens the gut barrier. That just sounds horrific. I mean,
yeah, it's definitely not ideal if you're trying to improve your health. But what I'd say is I would try to, and it may not work for everybody, but you can try to augment your GABAergic pathways and use things that have like a somewhat depressive effect that aren't alcohol. So
like Benadryl, progesterone.
Well, not even Benadryl. So there's others. Benadryl's one. So this is like a little bit separate, but there's a, Benadryl does have side effects in the sense that in the morning can make you kind of feel like a zombie. There's other things, and they're not necessarily like peat stuff, but there's stuff that I personally have used and like and work with clients and whatnot. But things along the lines like using valerian or using skullcap, incorporating magnesium and glycine and taurine, and then also L-theanine with that. There's like a litany of compounds ranging from like, those are obviously more mild. There's stronger ones that can be used to help deal with like having a relaxing effect. Cause a lot of times that's what it is. I come home after work and I need to unwind. So I'm going to unwind with a glass of wine. Mm-hmm. So what I've tried to do as an example for some of my clients is if they need to, that unwinding effect, what I'll do is I'll have them come home and then they can do either a mixture of pomegranate and grape juice. And they have, there's very special compounds in both of those, like beneficial effects. So you can have the pomegranate and grape juice, and you can add maybe magnesium glycinate. You can add a couple grams of glycine, a couple grams of taurine. You can add in some L-theanine, and you can add in lemon balm and skullcap and valerian. And you have like this combination that can help you unwind. And then all of those compounds, as long as you tolerate each one, has general health promoting properties. So they all work on GABA receptors and benzodiazepine receptors in the brain. They're not necessarily addictive compounds or habit forming or anything like that. And they do, when you stack them, are quite potent. If you try to just use L-theanine, some people are like, yeah, it's great. And other people are like, I don't feel anything. But when you combine the compounds together, you start to get a more potent effect. Vitamin C is also another one that has some GABA modulatory properties. So combining those things together, and then if you're using progesterone, if that's the point in your cycle, then progesterone can be used with that as well. And so you can try to, for me, I try to create different combinations to deal with these different things. So like, obviously there's other combinations for nicotine as well, but different story.
That's really cool. I love hearing that. I never really, and I have an herbalist background, and I never really thought of that concept of stacking them. I think maybe just because I've always been sensitive to herbal remedies, and I've always had to be careful because, you know, you do one thing and you're like, oh, that made me feel this way. And then you just don't want to do it again. But just experimenting with that, it's worth it. It's worth that than the whole opening the gut barrier concept, which you just like, that worked.
So with that said, there are things you can do to drastically improve your response to alcohol. So I call it with my clients, the alcohol rescue stack, basically. So, cause a lot, you know, you have to live your life too. And so for the holidays, or if you're going to go to weddings or you have parties or whatever it is,
or it's alcohol, Friday, just kidding.
it's Friday, but alcohol does have a social lubricant effect. And a lot of things aren't really that fun if alcohol's not involved. Like if you go to a wedding and you don't know anybody there because you're a plus one. So what you can do is you can use different substances that are easily available. You don't have to carry a pharmacy with you. Mm-hmm. What you would do is say you're going to go to a wedding. Before you go, make sure you – I would just take some type of B vitamins before and maybe a little bit after. Mm-hmm. Thiamine is very important for dealing with alcohol. And then if you bring a little bit of dark chocolate with you, dark chocolate, the polyphenolic compounds in it have a beneficial effect on the gut microbiome, and they're able to mitigate some of the negative effects of alcohol. Mm. And the other thing, this is quite interesting, and this goes hand in hand with the atherosclerosis process, is the saturated and monounsaturated fats inside the alcohol, or inside the chocolate, excuse me, are able to bind endotoxin. And something that people talk about is the idea that saturated fats increase endotoxin in the blood. And so they actually do. However, when endotoxin is bound to these fats, it doesn't stimulate a massive immune response, because the cells basically won't grab a hold of the endotoxin and have this triggering effect. So these fats are actually protective against endotoxin. So they've done studies in mice where they will give mice cream or different types of fat prior to inducing some type of endotoxemia, and it actually is protective of the endotoxemia for them. Mm. Other thing they do is, and so this is gives you some context for why does endotoxin increase cholesterol? Well, cholesterol, lipoproteins, HDL and LDL, and also the chylomicrons, which are the fat globules that you absorb from your intestine with the bile acids, mm-hmm. they're able to all bind endotoxin. They bring it back to the liver, and then the liver secretes it, detoxifies it, and secretes it out into circulation, and it actually protects the liver and the circulatory system. So wow. The cholesterol is protective against the endotoxin. So your body is saying, hey, secrete cholesterol so that we can bind up this endotoxin. And then the reason it binds it up is because if the immune cells, there's Kupffer cells or liver macrophages, if they get a hold of the endotoxin, they will trigger more of an immune response. So the body has kind of this self-limiting pathway where it'll just increase cholesterol, bind the endotoxin, and then you don't get as much of those immune cells secreting the different compounds, and the body can decrease the endotoxin in circulation, secrete it out, and hopefully the response is done and you're set to go. So having some type of saturated, monounsaturated fat source with the alcohol can be a bit protective of what's going on in the intestine and with the liver. Having the polyphenolic compounds can be protective. Having the B vitamins are protective. And then having some carbohydrate in the form of some fruit is also protective. So if you're going to have a screwdriver, vodka and orange juice, there is some protective effect with the orange juice because of the polyphenolic compounds in the orange juice, like naringenin. So those are super helpful. And as a side example, with the herbal stuff, a lot of people, I think, don't understand just how potent herbal compounds are, mm-hmm. but the naringenin compounds, there's some studies like decreasing liver enzymes in hepatitis C patients with using those polyphenol compounds. And then the skull cap is very rich in a compound called bakelin and another one called bakelin. And those compounds have very potent anti-cancer effects. They have very potent gut modulatory effects in terms of the microbiome, and they're very protective of the liver. So having these different polyphenolic compounds are one of the strategies that I use with my clients, creating a diet that's rich in that, pomegranate juice, grape juice, whole fruits, some cooked vegetables that are tolerated, to alter that ecosystem. So if you have, with the alcohol situation, just to recap for everybody, because I know I kind of covered different things, some polyphenolic compounds from some whole fruit, some fruit juice, some chocolate, some type of fat source. So dark chocolate would be ideal because you have more polyphenolic compounds there. You take some B vitamins with it. And then the other thing you can do is have some fiber and also eat a meal before. So eating a meal before that has some protein and some fat and some cooked vegetable fibers, or like while you're drinking, will help to protect your intestine against the damage. And then if you're going to choose your alcohol sources, I would probably choose something like a red wine, as long as you don't have negative effects from that, because it also comes with some polyphenolic compounds. Now, it's still not ideal. It's not a justification to have alcohol and tons of it, but that would probably be a better source. Or for people who are sensitive to it, I would go with a more distilled, clearer source of alcohol that doesn't have something called congeners, which are the other compounds in alcohol that can cause the hangovers and headaches and stuff. So maybe like a clear alcohol, like a vodka or something, and mix it with some juice.
Well, that's really, I mean, chocolate and fruit. That sounds like a good Friday night to me.
Yeah, chocolate covered strawberries and a glass of wine.
Right. That's perfect. That's good news. And of course, so was that information just in regards to how bad it is for you on so many levels. And so even though it's hard to hear, I think it's super important also. Okay. I want to just wrap it up, but I want to talk about, is there anything that you might have left out, or that you feel like you needed, really wanted to hit on? As I have one big question that's probably going to.
Was it the fatty liver thing?
Well, no, but you can speak on that if you wanted to. It was just about cholesterol in general and people that have really, really high cholesterol. I know that's quite general, but I know that also is really important for people who, for women who have, like undetectable levels of hormones and they're in perimenopause or menopause, and then they have extremely high cholesterol. And I know it's a thyroid issue and they're not converting the cholesterol, their livers and their thyroid. But if you can just dig in there a tiny bit, that would be cool.
So cholesterol in and of itself, let's start off just basically, is not bad. Cholesterol is extremely essential for multiple metabolic processes. And then there's a process to create cholesterol, and all the steps in between, all the intermediates have different functions in cellular function and enzymes, etc. So it's extremely important. Besides like the cholesterol itself being important inside the blood, and then also being the precursor to all steroid hormones. So demonizing cholesterol is like, it just doesn't make any sense. Like it's not even reality. And if you kind of go through the research and see some of the pathways to like look at cholesterol as like the problem, it just doesn't make any sense. Like it's not a reality. Yeah. What's more realistic is that if you have high cholesterol, there is some process that is leading to the upregulation of that high cholesterol. And then that leads to that pathology can lead to problems, particularly heart disease. Now, as I said, endotoxin can raise cholesterol. Hypothyroidism can raise cholesterol. Inflammatory stimulus in general can raise cholesterol. So the question is more, why are you seeing these elevations in the profile and how can we correct that? So that's the first thing. Elevated cholesterol is a symptom of an overarching process. The question is figuring out what that overarching process is. The medical solution currently is just stop your cholesterol production, which doesn't do that much, because, and it actually causes problems. And what they're finding and what the statin research shows is there was I forget the date, I think it was maybe 2004 or something like that. They changed the rules around clinical trials. And basically the industry funded statin trials ended after the review boards changed the rules. And then after they changed the rules, all the statin studies didn't show a significant benefit anymore. So before that, when they had a whole bunch of industry funding the scientists to do the studies on statins, oh, they're so wonderful. Everybody needs to be on a statin. When I was in high school, I was going to medical school classes because I went pre-med. So I was going earlier to like, you know, do all the stuff, shadow doctors, whatever. And one of the physicians, I remember I came home, I was so angry because the doctor was like, we need to put statins in the water supply. This is a level of ridiculousness that is just out of control. But that was the general idea. So after they changed the rules, the statin studies basically aren't showing any benefit. And then because cholesterol is so involved in all these processes, the statins can actually worsen mitochondrial function, possibly lead to worsening, like possibly in lead or worsen the progression towards diabetes, increase risk for certain infections, and possibly worsen heart disease and things along those lines, because the cholesterol intermediates are involved in like vitamin K function and mitochondrial function and selenoproteins, which are involved in glutathione production and utilization, and then also thyroid hormone function. So blocking those things is not a good idea. So that's the current treatment. Just let's stop the cholesterol production. Let's not look at why you're producing it in the first place. Highly problematic line of thinking. I would say it's probably like a not a really intelligent line of thinking, like, oh, cholesterol is high, let's just randomly lower it, instead of see why. So that's the first piece. The next piece is that LDL and HDL lipoproteins, all which people call cholesterol, all they do is carry fats and cholesterol lipids. So that's it. So that's a high LDL is saying your liver, it has a lot of cholesterol. You have a lot of cholesterol moving from your liver to your tissues or in circulation in general. And HDL is basically saying you, the cholesterol coming back from your tissues to your liver. That's, they basically just transport because lipids aren't soluble in water, right? You can't mix oil and water. So you need to add some type of protein to allow them to carry the actual lipid in your blood, which is water-based. So that's all the HDL and LDL are there for. And then the different types of VLDL, very low density lipoproteins, versus LDL, which is low density lipoproteins, etc. And then the different types of apoproteins, so apoprotein E, apoprotein B, those are all just different carriers that have different functions on, like, in carrying the cholesterol and whatnot. And then the different, like, VLDL or LDL is just like how much cholesterol has been unloaded and is at different phases in transport. So it's just a system of transporting these lipids to cells and back. That's really what's going on. Now, those, like, the amounts of those are somewhat important, again, because they're indicative of problems. But the question is, what are they carrying? So with atherosclerosis or heart disease, what you see in plaques isn't regular cholesterol. It's not just like, oh, it's just normal cholesterol. It's largely oxidized cholesterol. So cholesterol that has been damaged via lipid peroxidation. So it's and that those oxidized cholesterol trigger an immune response. It actually triggers those same receptors that endotoxin does, called toll-like receptors. So it triggers those, and then that causes immune cells to move in, and the immune cells kind of gobble up that cholesterol. And then they actually can only hold a certain amount. They become foam cells because they're so engorged with these lipids. And then they die from the oxidized lipids. And that's where you start to see plaque formation, is you have a whole bunch of immune cells, a whole bunch of damaged fats, and then a whole bunch of these, like, dead immune cells. And that's what the plaques are on the artery. So what's happening there, and why the immune cells are gobbling it up, is because the damaged fats are directly damaging to the endothelial cells lining the vessels. So when you have damage to the endothelial cells, they upregulate the production of these proteins, these extracellular matrix proteins that kind of thicken up the artery, kind of like a callus. Mm. Like if you cut, you get like a thicker scarred area. Mm-hmm. Same thing happens in the arteries. They start to ramp that up, and then they can also, that attracts some of the cholesterol, and the cholesterol kind of creates a spackle layer to protect the vasculature, right? So it kind of, if you have this damage, it kind of protects it. It covers it up, so you don't have blood leaking all over the place. But if the cholesterol is very heavy in polyunsaturated fatty acids, which are very liable to peroxidation, then they can oxidize. And so what winds up happening is the oxidized cholesterol triggers immune cells to come in. You get an increase of that extracellular matrix, that callus formation, which creates a bigger net to trap more of those immune cells and more cholesterol. And then the immune cells start dying, and then you have inflammatory mediators. And so it's like this feed forward reaction that's occurring because you have a damage to the vasculature. The body uses some of that cholesterol to try to protect it, and we'll talk about what it should be using instead. And then if you have your cholesterol, your LDL proteins loaded with polyunsaturated fatty acids, they can oxidize and you get this immune response. So the problem, and so something to keep in mind, is things like endotoxin lead to vascular inflammation, that, and the endotoxin leads to immune response that can oxidize fats. So it's a double whammy. It increases cholesterol, causes inflammation in the vasculature, and then allows that the fats to oxidize and then start to form plaques in the vasculature. So it's like, it's twofold negative effect. It's very potent in that effect. It's why keeping endotoxin low is so important.
And avoiding PUFA.
And avoiding PUFA, exactly. So the question is, why is your cholesterol elevated first? And then the second question is, what is your cholesterol? What are the lipoproteins carrying? Is your cholesterol largely monounsaturated and saturated fats? Then you're less likely to have that oxidative stress. So it's not going to be you know, the fats aren't going to oxidize so readily. Whereas if you have loaded up on vegetable oil, omega-6 fats, then yeah, you're probably going to get pretty loaded with oxidized fats. And if you have any type of elevated cholesterol and then subsequent damage to the vessels, well, now you've just lit the fuse to the dynamite, because now you're essentially going to pull in all this oxidized cholesterol, and then the immune cells start to trigger. The other thing to keep in mind is the polyunsaturated fats are the precursor for the inflammatory mediators. So it's like you just have this pool of oxidized damaged fats, and you have substrate for prostaglandin formation and leukotriene formation, which worsens that process. So that's another thing. What is your cholesterol carrying? And why? The first one is, why is it elevated in the first place? Now, there's another part to it. I know it's a little like slightly complex, but there's a very famous researcher. His name was Linus Pauling, and he was like the vitamin C man. That's what everybody knows him for, but he's done like a lot of other invaluable work. He was like a brilliant chemist, and vitamin C was just one of the things. But what he basically, his hypothesis, it's called the Pauling hypothesis of heart disease. What he found was that vitamin C is required for adequate collagenous synthesis inside the vasculature. It basically allows the vasculature to be sturdy enough so that you're not leaking blood all over the place, right? Because your arteries are under pressure from this fluid all the time. And if you had a pipe that was 90 years old and it didn't have a reparative process, I'm sure you would find erosion inside that pipe, particularly if you have this constant like pressure and then no pressure and pressure and then no pressure. So you have this process of creating pressure inside the arteries, and that's like in that they're inside itself, there's stress on the arterial walls. So in his hypothesis, what he found is that when you don't have adequate vitamin C, you get something called scurvy. And the number one effect of scurvy is leakage of blood out of the vasculature. So when you have adequate vitamin C in animals that produce their own vitamin C, you usually don't see any heart disease because they can repair their vascular walls pretty quick from the damage that they are experiencing just from like living, right? Just from pumping blood, the heart pumping blood hundreds of thousands of times a day. Now, humans and another type of animal called guinea pigs don't produce, and primates in general don't produce their own vitamin C. So what winds up happening is what Linus Pauling hypothesizes, that heart disease in humans is a subclinical vitamin D deficiency over time. And the cholesterol plaques are there to kind of shore up the vascular walls when they can't repair themselves because they don't have adequate vitamin C. And the reason why vitamin C is important, again, it is the cofactor for collagen synthesis. So it allows your body to rebuild collagen in damaged areas. So basically what he did is he found that there's a specific type of lipoprotein called lipoprotein little A. So it's usually lipoprotein and an A in parentheses. And that protein is only generally found in animals that don't produce their own vitamin C. And it's really good at forming plaques. So there's this, what you see in cardiovascular research is high levels of lipoprotein A are strongly associated with cardiovascular disease more than any of the other lipoprotein mediators. And that's because the lipoprotein A, is the structure, is really good at binding into the vascular wall. And that's on purpose, so that when you don't produce your own vitamin C, you're able to protect yourself against your collagenous structure breaking down over time. So adequate vitamin C intake, as well as improving gut barrier function and improving immune function to deal with endotoxin, is also quite important for maintaining a vascular integrity. And then the other thing that is part of the protocol, two amino acids, lysine and proline, are able to bind onto the binding sites of the lipoproteins and inhibit their ability to stick to the vascular wall. So the protocol is vitamin C, lysine, and proline. So when you put that into context, you can kind of contextualize the heart disease cholesterol process, right? You have you need to have an initiating damage to the wall of the vasculature for the cholesterol to come in and kind of stick. It doesn't just randomly do it. And so having adequate vitamin C sufficiency over a long time can help to prevent the different damage. And you have damage just in general because you have high pressure areas around the heart that have altered turbulent blood flow that kind of degrade the vascular wall over time. Then the next thing is, if you have some type of inflammatory stimulus with cholesterol, that's raising cholesterol, that obviously would also alter what's going on with the vascular wall. So you're going to want to make sure that you're correcting that underlying process instead of just cutting off cholesterol. Then the next piece is you want to adjust what you have in your cholesterol. Do you have a lot of polyunsaturated fats? If you do, you probably want to adjust that. And then having adequate like vitamin E intake, vitamin C intake, and then having adequate plant compounds have actually been shown, for example, olive leaf extract has been shown to inhibit the oxidative damage to LDL particles or fats within LDL. So it's like you want to, what's in your cholesterol, damage to the vascular wall, and then also what's causing this elevation in cholesterol from the get-go. And that's the, I would look at those processes more in depth than just like your cholesterol's high, let's just arbitrarily lower it. Why is it high? What's the underlying cause? And how can we mediate all these other processes so that even though it's high, it's not going to go stick inside the vascular wall?
Yeah. That is incredible, because this is something that we talk about constantly, which is just this cholesterol issue. And so even beyond knowing that, you know, almost everyone in the group now knows that the whole, you know, fallacy behind a cholesterol being bad, but, you know, just also, I think a really common thing is just having this, you know, high LDL. And I think the PUFA thing is really, really, really prevalent in all of the women in the group and my experience. So that was incredible information for sure.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything else you'd like to, you've given me so much of your time. Is there anything else you want to add? I have to have you back, by the way.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
It's important because I you're such a good teacher, and there's something that a lot of guests have, a lot of guests do that you don't do, which is that they get hyperclinical and they don't take the time to explain. And so and then you lose a lot of just, you know, as they say, Susan in Minnesota or whatever, you lose those people who are just want to know the juice, you know? And so you're really good at extracting that. And that's super important. So that's why
I'm trying my best to break it down. The only other thing I wanted to answer your initial question about cholesterol is that, and just talk about a relationship here with thyroid and estrogen dominance. So because I want to put it into perspective for your audience, so that, because it's something that's very relevant to them. A lot of this is relevant, but the estrogen dominance is like an underlying category. So as far as cholesterol levels, thyroid hormone is extremely important for allowing your cells to take up cholesterol. It increases the LDL receptor on cells so that you can take in that cholesterol coming from the liver. And then not only that, there's a protein that takes the cholesterol from the inner part of the cell and brings it into the mitochondria. And why is that important? The mitochondria is what takes the cholesterol and converts it into steroid hormones. Mm. And so thyroid hormone also upregulates that protein. It's called the STAR protein. I know it's a very nice name. Yeah. So it's called, steroid acute regulatory protein.
Wow. I've never heard of that.
Yeah. So thyroid does both of those things. It increases LDL uptake in the cells, and then it increases the uptake of cholesterol into the mitochondria to produce steroid hormones. Because the first step for producing steroid hormones is that conversion from cholesterol to pregnenolone, and that has to happen inside the mitochondria. So if you have low thyroid hormones and you have elevated cholesterol, or you have low gonadotropin hormones or gonadal hormones, progesterone, estrogen, etc., what you want to start to look at is, okay, what's going on with thyroid? And thyroid's directly tied with fertility partly through that process. And also it's extremely important for fertility function and things along those lines, or even general health from a hormonal perspective. But the thyroid is extremely important in lowering cholesterol and turning it into actual steroid hormones. With estrogen, if it's lowering your thyroid function, then it can be directly lowering the output or production of thyroid hormone through the mitochondria, because now the estrogen is taking that cholesterol, bringing it to the liver, having it excreted, and then it's also impairing thyroid hormone's function ability to take that cholesterol, bring it into the cell, and then convert it into steroid hormones by bringing it into the mitochondria. So that's something that I think is really important. Now, again, doesn't mean you want to obliterate estrogen. That high amounts of estrogen have a negative impact on thyroid function. When you have adequate thyroid function, when you have adequate hormonal function, your ovaries will produce estrogen. That's a normal situation. It's involved with the cycling of hormones. It's important for fertility and pregnancy. But if you're also not producing adequate progesterone, or you're under stress and you have prolactin elevated and cortisol elevated, then you start to see problems where estrogen starts to go awry. Or if you have very large amounts of fat tissue, the androgens that you are producing in women, a lot of them come from the adrenal glands, DHEA. In those circumstances, the DHEA can largely be aromatized into estrogen. And then now you start to see the estrogen dominance. And then the second piece is if you're under large amounts of stress, your body does secrete a lot of cortisol. And that elevated cortisol usually comes with elevated DHEA. The problem is, and DHEA protects against cortisol. The problem is that cortisol over time also upregulates aromatase. So DHEA is heavily aromatizable, which means it can be converted to estrogen. So if you're under stress, the cortisol raises, DHEA raises, and you can start to see that DHEA start to convert into estrogen. Or in women with PCOS, I think the DHEA was raising their testosterone to a large extent. So that's a different story, but just interesting things to keep
that's
in mind.
What I'll have you back about. That's a big deal. That's a huge topic conversation. That's so cool though, because my main admin in the group, Sharon, she actually started taking the thyroid hormone, the thyroid that she hadn't, I think she started taking a desiccated thyroid. And that was one of the first things that happened to her in the first month, was that her LDL had come down, and she was so happy, you know, and it came into a healthy range. And, her total also just came into a healthy range and started to feel changes, you know, and that's a big deal for, especially for menopausal women, but also for, you know, like you were saying, for someone who's trying to get pregnant. And I mean, that stuff, that was the ticket I was looking for there, hoping for to hear and to understand further, was the thyroid component to cholesterol and how important it is in order to convert that cholesterol into the hormones that we need so badly. So thank you for that.
Yeah, no problem. And if you have women who are dealing with high cholesterol, some easy ways to adjust it, especially if they just move to a bioenergetic approach. First things first, look at what's going on with thyroid. A thyroid supplement is like textbook known to lower cholesterol. And it's through the pathways that I just discussed. This is like, it's known in the research, but like outside of like PubMed, nobody really talks about these things.
Yeah.
The next thing that's really important is making sure that you are having adequate carbohydrate intake and you're having adequate fiber intake from fruits and vegetables and things like that. That'll modulate the microbiome and it'll help to deal with the cholesterol. And then the other thing, a lot of people come to the bioenergetic sphere and they go heavy on saturated fats first, or they're coming out of keto or carnivore or low carb or things like that, or paleo, and they have high saturated fat intake. If some people can respond with that high saturated fat intake to really bump up their cholesterol, you can move towards like a more monounsaturated fat intake, and that can also help to lower that cholesterol.
Okay.
So fiber, monounsaturated fats, thyroid's important. Carbohydrate intake is extremely important. I had a client I talked to today. Cholesterol was like in the 400s.
Whoa.
And he, before we worked together, he just came to bioenergetic. He started introducing carbs and he's already back down to the 200s. So the low carb keto carnivore can 100% lead to like sky high cholesterol. And it's through altered thyroid hormone signaling, the hormonal changes, and then changes in fatty acid metabolism. So that's par for the course for those situations. Wow. Probably not a good thing long term, but just something to keep in mind for if you have any women coming from those backgrounds to the group.
Wow. Yeah. No, that's good. That's good to know, because there are a lot of women who are still in the group, even though we're talking about the low carb, the importance of healthy carbohydrates, and you know, that are still like pushing back against this. But yeah, I mean, the profile for these women, they should definitely, most of them should not be on low carb diets for sure.
Yep.
Amazing.
Great.
Oh, that was so good. I thank you so much for your time. You were super generous. I appreciate that. I was the interview with Georgie today was also pretty long. So I thank you for that. I really do.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me. And I'm hopeful that, you know, some of the little tidbits I drop here and there are able to help some of the women in your group get to a better spot health-wise and maybe see some improvements in their cholesterol or some of their hormones, etc.
Oh my gosh. honestly, I was floored by this podcast, but then when I edited it, when I edited this podcast, I was sitting there taking notes and just like he's just talking about me. I mean, I have my gallbladder, but yeah, you know, I've shared with you guys a lot that I have notoriously high cholesterol, like notoriously high, my LDL, my HDL, crazy numbers, like well over into the 300s, nuts. And I started taking a thyroid, a natural thyroid, and already, as I mentioned about Sharon, already things are changing, and I can't wait to start to take. I'm going to do a bunch of labs, including Georgie Dinkoff's nail and hair lab, to get my estrogen in the tissue levels, you know. And of course, I'm going to do a Dutch, and then I'm also going to go get some blood labs done. And I just want to see what has changed. And if nothing changes, I tell you right now, as God and all of you as my witnesses, I'm quitting this. I'm quitting this job. I'm not going to be healthy anymore. And I am going to just have a podcast about silly things. And actually, you know what? I was going to start a podcast with my husband called CNC Music Factory. You, if you're my age, you know who that is. But only not has nothing to do with music. It's just that Charles and Catalina, that's my full name, Catalina. So Charles and Catalina, right? The CNC Music Factory, just because it's funny. And we were just going to go to restaurants all over the planet and just sit down with our phone and record and do a review as we eat the food and just talk about the food as we're eating it to each other. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to quit my job. If my cholesterol is still in the 300s after all this work that I've done and my hormone levels are still undetectable, I am quitting. And I'm not joking. Anyway, friends, I hope you enjoyed Nurse Fave as much as I did. He was my fave. And also don't forget about Just Thrive spore-based probiotics, because those spore-based probiotics are going to really help you with that endotoxin that he talked about, right? Was that mind-blowing? The whole endotoxin thing was just crazy. Don't forget to use your coupon code HGG20 and get 20% off of any and all of whatever you purchase from Just Thrive. And they have vitamin K, and they have spore-based probiotics, and they have the prebiotics, and they have a whole bunch of new stuff that I didn't even know about. Just found out about it. So check out their website. They've got new things, and use your coupon code. And of course, if you want to reach out to Mike Fave, please look at him up, check out the show notes and look him up on Instagram and online. Everything is there in the show notes. He is going to start seeing people telemed style. So I would highly recommend that you reach out to him, because he is the bomb.